am going to get straight into it with my first prediction, as it were, being that what is turning out to be the longest period of above-trend growth in the global economy since before the first oil shock of 1973 is set to continue in 2007 and, for that matter, 2008. In two of the past 3 years, the world economy has grown by more than 5%. This year, I suspect it will grow by about 4.5%, largely on account of the slowdown in the United States economy that has unfolded in the past few months, as the US economy has found itself in a similar position to where Britain and the east coast of Australia have been over the past 2 years, in the aftermath of a housing boom that has come to an end, but without the dire consequences for housing prices themselves or for household expenditure that have been predicted in magazines such as The Economist whenever house prices have been measured and thought to be reaching a peak. More importantly, though, the growth in the world economy is going to continue to be driven, not as it usually has been by the so-called advanced economies, but rather as it has been during this cycle to a much greater extent than ever before, by what's happening in the developing economies. To a large extent, that's simply a matter of mathematics. As this chart here suggests, growth in the developing economies has been averaging more than 7% per annum in recent years, while growth in the developed world, held back by poor performances in Japan and Western Europe, has been averaging less than 3%. This year, Western Europe is likely to do, by its standards, surprisingly well, and Japan will be doing, by the standards of the past 10 years, moderately well, while the US does a little worse than it has done over the past 3 or 4 years. But the developing countries will be contributing something close to two-thirds of the growth in the world economy, even though their share of the level of economic activity throughout the world is only about 50%. Conversely, the rich countries, which represent about 50% of global GDP, will be contributing only about a third of the growth in GDP. At the heart of this is, of course, China, with about 12% of the world economy measured at purchasing power parity, as it should be, but by itself contributing over a quarter of the growth in the global economy year by year. And even though China's economy may slow a little from last year's 10.4% to something in the mid to high nines, the overwhelming contribution that China will make to growth in the global economy and to the fortunes of commodity markets will still be the most important single factor driving the shape of the world economy. But it's important to understand that the contribution that the developing economies are making to growth in the world economy goes beyond the sheer mathematics of their own growth rates relative to those of the industrialized world. There are at least two other ways in which growth in the developing economies is contributing to faster growth than would otherwise be possible in the developed world as well. The first of those is that the developing economies are providing a source of competitive discipline on the price setting and wage setting behaviour of firms and employees in industrialised countries that didn't exist 25 or 30 years ago. As the chart on the left suggests, the prices of goods imported into the United States from China have fallen by an average of about 1.5% per annum for the last 3 years, or by about 8% in total. Over the same period, the prices of goods imported into the United States from other countries, excluding oil, have risen by about 14%, while the prices of goods produced within the United States itself have risen by about 11%. The discipline imposed on price and wage setting behaviour in countries such as the United States by the existence of cheaper goods, and in the case of India, in particular, services from other countries, and the knowledge of the consequences of raising prices or labour costs at a faster rate in the rich countries, has prevented the third oil shock of 2002 through 2005 from having the same consequences for inflation, interest rates, and ultimately for growth that the first two oil shocks, which proportionately were not that much different from the most recent one. from being repeated in the most recent episode. The main reason why the third oil shock didn't have the consequences for global growth, inflation and interest rates that the first two did was this newfound source of discipline on the ability of workers and businesses to play pass the parcel with higher oil prices in the way that they did during the 1970s and 80s. The second key way in which growth in the developing economies is enabling faster growth in the industrialized countries is that, contrary to the normal predictions of economic theory, capital is now flowing uphill in the world. Would that it be that we could solve our own water crisis in the same way? But whereas throughout most of recorded human history, investment dollars have flown from rich, mature countries, where opportunities are thought to be more limited, to poorer but developing economies with much greater potential. Since the Asian crisis and its parallel crises in Latin America, Russia and elsewhere of the late 1990s, capital has instead flowed from the poor world to the rich world. That's partly been because investment in developing countries has continued to be, in many cases other than China, adversely affected by the longer term consequences of those financial crises. And it's been partly because governments in those countries, particularly but not exclusively China, have resisted upward pressure on their own exchange rates arising from their persistent current account surpluses, and so indirectly via their central banks have lent large and growing sums to the United States in particular, but also other Western countries running large current account deficits such as Britain, Australia, Spain and New Zealand. That's been supplemented by large capital outflows from Japan, which is of course a rich country, but one which after a decade of zero or negative inflation has become accustomed to the idea that interest rates are going to remain at or close to zero forever, and that therefore a growing proportion of Japan's rapidly aging population is increasingly willing to take on currency risk in order to achieve rates of return that will allow them to live at decent standards of living in retirement. And so the combination of huge capital flows from developing countries and from Japan to other rich countries which are running current account deficits is not only putting downward pressure on the yen at a time when you would otherwise not expect it, but also keeping long-term interest rates around the world at much lower levels than would otherwise have been the case, given the upward movements in short-term interest rates that we've seen in the developed world since about 2004. That in turn has lowered the thresholds which businesses use to decide whether to go ahead with physical investments, increasing the level of investment in Western countries and contributing to growth, and allowed consumers in Western countries to continue spending more than they earn on other goods and services, contributing to growth in that field as well. The low level of long-term interest rates has in turn encouraged investors to take on more and more risk in pursuit of higher rates of return, which has narrowed the spread between riskier assets such as corporate or emerging market bonds and pushed up the prices of riskier assets such as shares, and is in turn part of the reason behind the flood of capital into what we now know as private equity, including, as we've seen in the last 6 months, in countries like Australia. So developing countries are contributing to what I described as the longest period of above-trend growth that the world has seen for 30 years, not only because they are themselves growing rapidly and they represent a growing share of the world economy, but also because they are disciplining inflationary behaviour, or what would otherwise be inflationary behaviour, leading to higher interest rates and a downturn in growth in the world's rich countries, and because they are directly and indirectly financing part of the growth in rich countries and boosting asset prices and encouraging greater risk-taking in those countries. Now, forests have been felled and gallons of ink spilled over the last 3 years by pundits predicting with the same accuracy as some of the foreign affairs pundits that Michael Fullagrove just referred to, that all of these things are unsustainable and must inevitably come to an end. As Chris Caton says in his document that you have before you, The point about the boy who cried wolf was that there was eventually a wolf. But none of the warnings about the risks associated with large imbalances between the United States and some of its major trading partners, leading inevitably to a sharp fall in the dollar and to a rise in US interest rates and thus curtailing this period of strong growth, have yet come to fruition. And I don't think 2007 is going to be the year in which they do. Rather, I think the risks to economic growth over the medium term are more of a geopolitical or indeed geophysical nature. One of those, of course, is climate change. 2006 turned out to be a tipping point for political and business attitudes towards the issue of climate change. There are still those, and they're not to be entirely dismissed, who are sceptical about some of the science behind warnings around global warming. And that's partly because those who have promoted the urgency of action on climate change have refused to open up some of their scientific conclusions to scrutiny from those who are suspected of not agreeing with them a priori. For example, this chart, which you've often seen, of global surface temperatures over the last 150 years, is compiled by a group of researchers at East Anglia University who have refused to disclose to anyone else the basis on which they've derived those estimates. Nonetheless, estimates for our own much more accountable and reliable Bureau of Meteorology do point in the same direction, and so I'm not here questioning the scientific basis for the conclusions which were most recently highlighted by the fourth IPCC report released a couple of Fridays ago. The tipping point in attitudes to climate change probably stemmed from Al Gore's film An Inconvenient Truth, which many of you will have seen. And as you'll know, he is, among other things, up for an Oscar for that film. He may well get it for Best Supporting Actor for his role in the Clinton White House rather than for promoting greater awareness on climate change. And I have to say, personally, there's something rather appealing about the idea that you can make a film about a guy going around giving PowerPoint presentations and get an Oscar for it. Maybe there's hope for me yet. But it is undoubtedly becoming a much more serious global and political issue. The really serious issue in terms of its impact on the global economy is that the bulk of the increases in emissions that are generally believed to be the cause of global warming are coming, as is most of the economic growth now, from the developing countries who are not party to the Kyoto Protocol. And any effort seriously to ameliorate global warming has to bring them into the picture. On the other hand, those countries are quite soundly or legitimately entitled to say to the rich world, you filled up the world with filthy gases that are damaging the climate and the planet. Why should you deny us the right to get rich in the same way that you did? So the only way to resolve this paradox, in my view, is for the developing countries to make the same sort of effort to reduce greenhouse gases as rich countries are obliged to do, but that the rich countries are going to have to subsidise some of the cost of developing countries of doing that. Which is in turn why, and I'm speaking only personally here, countries like Australia cannot absolve themselves from any responsibility to show leadership on these issues simply because our own contribution to developing to greenhouse gas emissions is relatively small. A second issue, which is a potential threat to the sustainability of the global economic growth that we've seen over the last few years, is the growing risk of a protectionist backlash against one of the principal sources of it, namely China's growing presence in the international trading system. Politically, it's no longer sustainable for China's exports to continue to grow at an average annual rate of 30% when the world as a whole's exports are only growing by about 10 or 11%, now that China's exports represent about 9% of the total, compared with less than 2% a decade ago, and when China now ranks as the third biggest exporter in the world, shortly, within the next 2 years, to overtake both the United States and Germany. Now, don't get me wrong here, I am not advocating protection in any form at all. Protection in all its forms is essentially about ripping off consumers in your own country by forcing them to pay high prices for a narrow range of goods in order to prop up industries which can't compete. But the fact that an idea is uniformly regarded by economists as bad policy in no way suggests that it won't be adopted by governments. And the risk that there will be a protectionist backlash against China's presence in the world trading system is, of course, heightened by the fact that the congressional elections in November last year brought a number of unabashed protectionists to positions of political power in Washington. And their political power is enhanced by the third trend in the world economy that potentially represents a source of risk to it. And that is that the combination of globalization and technological change, backed by some decisions on the part of government, particularly the Bush administration, has resulted in the dividends from what are overwhelmingly favourable trends in the global economy accruing to a very small proportion of the population of the United States and, for that matter, of other countries. The profit share of US national income in recent years has been higher than at any time in at least the last 80 years. And tax policies of the Bush administration have reinforced the tendency of globalization and technological change, and the entry of some 3 billion workers into the global labor market, thus increasing the scarcity of capital relative to labor, has skewed further the tendency for most of the dividends to accrue to profits rather than labor. And within the labour share of national income in the United States, admittedly to a greater extent than in other countries, such of the increase in income that has gone to labour has overwhelmingly gone to the highest rewarded, the highest income earning labour. Now, again, I'm not necessarily advocating redistributionist policies to correct that, but what I advocate or criticise is of no relevance to the outcome of US elections. There is a growing risk, based on the skewing of the distribution of income in the United States over the last 10 years, of governments, particularly if the Democrats capture the White House as well as both houses of the legislature, of policies that will, for good intent or otherwise, undermine many of the drivers of the prosperity that the global economy has seen over the past five or so years. And so, as I say, while one can easily, and many economists do, point to financial or economic risks associated with major imbalances among the world's major economies, my sense is that the more important risks over the medium term to the prosperity that the world has been enjoying in recent years come either from geophysics or from geopolitics. Let me now, however, turn to look at the Australian economy, and here I want to quickly sketch over perhaps two themes about the Australian economy. The first of those is one perspective that you will undoubtedly hear about the Australian economy over the next 8 months, and the second is an alternative perspective. And both of them are essentially true. They represent different ways of thinking about the same set of facts. The Australian economy is now in its 16th year of continuous economic growth. It's been more than 15 years since Australia had two quarters or more in a row of negative growth, and that's the longest that we have gone without a recession, not only since quarterly data became available in September 1959, but based on annual data since at least 1901, if not since 1788. And since avoidance of recessions is one of the cardinal objectives of economic policy, not least since economic policymakers tend to lose their jobs in recessions, that's something for which economic policymakers are going to, and broadly speaking are entitled to, claim a good deal of credit for. Moreover, the unemployment rate is at 4.5%, the lowest it's been for more than 30 years. And while it is higher than it was in the 50s and 60s, back then half the potential workforce was effectively excluded from participating in the labour market by legal and social barriers against the employment of women. So some credit can also be claimed for the fact that the proportion of the working age population who has a job is the highest that it has ever been outside of wartime. Although both inflation and interest rates have risen over the last few years, they might have peaked in the last quarter, and in any case, they are still exceptionally low by historical standards. As in the United States, much of the fruits of growth have gone to corporates rather than to workers. But from a business perspective, the fact that the corporate profit share is at an all-time high means that although the share market is also at an all-time high as the index closes in on 6,000, the share market is not expensive in terms of price-earnings ratios compared with the recent past, let alone with 1987. And that in turn reflects the fact that the corporate sector's balance sheet is in an extraordinarily strong position in aggregate compared with the 1980s, a point which needs to be set against the concern many have about the state of household balance sheets. It's also, of course, yet another reason for the enthusiasm of investors for private equity in recent years, that many people perceive that the corporate sector as a whole, after years of de-gearing, now has a lazy balance sheet. And not only is the corporate sector in very sound financial shape, but of course, by both historical and international standards, the public sector is in very good financial shape. And so you will hear one side of politics point to all of those facts and say, vote for me. You will probably also hear the other side of politics say, well, yes, the Australian economy is in very good shape and has performed very well, but it's done so under a set of circumstances that has been extraordinarily propitious for the Australian economy. It's been much easier, for example, for the Australian economy to record strong and stable growth over the last 15 years when the world economy has also been doing the same thing. It's been much easier for Australia to maintain low inflation and low interest rates when the world economy has been doing the same thing. The Treasurer often likes to say that he has single-handedly not only raised the birth rate through tax measures, not in the other sense, but seen off the Asian financial crisis and the post-tech wreck downturn in the global economy, and that these were the most serious challenges that the world has faced since the Great Depression. Truth is, both of them, though they were serious, were Sunday school picnics compared with the first two oil shocks of the 1970s and the Volcker interest rate shock in the United States of the early 1980s. But even more importantly than that, the last 15 years, and the last 5 years in particular, have seen something that, from an Australian perspective, has not really been seen more than once or twice in the last 110 years. And that is that, in contrast to the experience of most of the 20th century, in the last 15 and especially in the last five, the prices of the things that we export to the rest of the world have been going up relative to the prices of the things that we import from the rest of the world, so that our terms of trade, which is what we get for what we buy, are now more favourable to us than at any time really since the early 1950s. And of course China is at the heart of that because of the almost unique complementarity between Australia's position as a net exporter of commodities and an importer of manufactured goods and China's as a globally significant importer of commodities and exporter of manufactured goods. The boost to Australia's terms of trade has raised Australians' incomes relative to what we produce by about 1 percentage point per annum, or by over $3,000 per head per annum for every individual Australian. Many of the drivers of our good growth over the past 15 years or so are unfortunately now beginning to fade. Outside of Perth and Darwin, the housing boom ended about 2 years ago, and as a result, consumers in those states, and I would argue we're not too far away from consumers in the West and North joining them, have become more cautious about borrowing and spending now that their houses are not going up in value by 10% per annum or more year after year. Business investment spending, which took over some of the momentum of growth in the economy after the end of the housing boom, appears to have reached a peak and is now no longer growing as rapidly as it once was. In circumstances that have been unusually propitious for Australian exporters, they have done an appalling job of increasing the volume of exports, partly because of capacity constraints in the resources sector and partly because of the impact that the commodity boom has had on the exchange rate and hence on the competitiveness of non-resource exporters. And finally, the productivity miracle. that was the sustainable heart of Australia's improved economic performance in the 1990s, has evaporated like large parts of the Murray-Darling River system. The housing boom, as I've said, is over outside of Perth and Darwin. Contrary to what you might have expected if your only source of information was The Economist or the Financial Times, that hasn't been followed by a precipitate decline in house prices, and I don't think there will be one. But it is nonetheless telling for the outlook for the Australian economy that not only have house prices stopped rising, except in those two parts of the country, but that new housing construction activity has been subtracting from, rather than adding to, growth in the economy in recent years. As households have become more cautious, not only because their house prices are no longer going up, but because they're paying more to service their mortgages than they have ever done before, even though rates remain low by historical standards, they are no longer spending as much in excess of their incomes on other goods and services as they used to do. And once the boom in house prices in Perth and Darwin has ended, the aggregate household saving rate will probably return to positive again, so that consumer spending is likely to remain more subdued than it has been for most of the last 15 years. The mining investment boom, as I've said, appears to have passed its peak. Investment remains at a very high level, and that is helping slowly to alleviate some of the capacity constraints that businesses have faced in recent years. But it's clear that the periods of double-digit rate of growth in business investment, which is what counts for driving economic growth, have now begun to fade into history. Over the last 5 years, the volume of our exports has grown at a slower rate than over any five-year period in at least the last 50 years, apart perhaps from the global downturn plus drought of the early 1980s. And whereas much of the growth in the global economy has been as a result of a rising share of exports in total economic activity, here in Australia, and bear in mind this is during a period which has hardly ever been more favourable for the kind of things that we export, the share of exports in Australia's GDP has actually gone down over the last 5 years to be back where it was in the early 1990s. Not much globalisation for Australia here compared with the rest of the world. As I say, to some extent that reflects capacity constraints in the resources sector itself, which the strong investment growth of the last few years may do something to ameliorate. But other exporters have been hampered by a combination of drought and by an elevated exchange rate, a byproduct of the commodity price boom, that has undermined their international competitiveness. And even though Treasury and others like to tell a story of, like, waiting for Godot, merely hoping that the increased investment of recent years will surely at some point lead to a tidal wave of resources exports, the truth actually is that exports of products like coal and iron ore and alumina and natural gas have been increasing over the last few years, but that has been more than offset by the decline in petroleum product exports as our fields to the southeast and to a lesser extent the northwest of the country gradually become more and more depleted. And finally, and perhaps most disconcertingly, the productivity miracle that was at the heart of our sustainable improvement in economic performance in the 1990s appears to have gone into reverse. For the past 3 years, productivity growth in Australia, that is output per hour worked, has been lower than at any point since before the recession of the early 1990s. And the improvement in Australia's level of productivity as a proportion of the US as a benchmark for world's best practice, which went from about 80% in 1990 to a peak of 88% in the late 1990s, has since fallen back to about 82% where we were in 92. To some extent, the slowdown in productivity growth reflects where we are in the business cycle, that the labour which is now being taken into employment is perhaps almost by definition less productive than that which was first employed 5 or 15 years ago. It also, however, reflects two more disturbing trends. One, the absence of any of the productivity-enhancing reforms that according to all of the research that's ever been done on this subject, were the main reason for the improvement in our productivity performance in the 1990s. There's been almost none of those since 1998, and there's now quite a long list of sectors ranging at the small end from pharmacies and newsagents to at the big end health insurance and international aviation, which have been exempted from productivity enhancing reforms by the federal government. And secondly, there has, instead of productivity enhancing reform, been a deluge of productivity stifling legislation and regulation since 2001, ostensibly with the objective of improving national security or standards of corporate governance. In my view, not doing either of those, how many terrorists are foiled by having people confiscating shaving cream and making mothers taste their baby milk at airports? Or, as happened to me in my own building 2 weeks ago, making five-year-olds sign in to gain access to offices. But instead, that legislation has required the employment of tens of thousands of people who do absolutely nothing of any value themselves but detract from the productivity of and add to the cost of people who actually are doing something useful as part of their daily business. So, with productivity growth having gone into reverse, as it were, much of the sustainable basis for the improvement in Australia's productivity performance appears to have evaporated. And all of these things, I think, are as factually based as all of the good things that you can say about Australia's economic performance over the last 15 years. And you will undoubtedly hear another group of politics say, vote for them on that basis. One other observation I'd make is that not only have the global circumstances of the last 15 years been propitious for Australian business, but since nearly all of the improvement in commodity prices is accrued in the first instance to companies who share 30% of that with the federal government through the tax system, they've been extraordinarily propitious for government. Going back through the last 4 years' worth of budget papers, each of which is for a four-year forward estimates period, so we're talking about 8 years in total, what the finance boffins call parameter variations, and what President Bush might have called misunderestimates of revenue, have given the government a total of $283 billion more to play with over the 8 year period shown here than they had initially expected. Of that $283 billion windfall, government has spent or given away in tax cuts all but $17 billion of it. And most of that $17 billion has accrued in the 6 weeks between when the budget's brought down in May each year and the end of the financial year, during which presumably there aren't enough weeks left to spend all the extra lolly that they've discovered is in the Treasury. I guess it's not up to me to say whether the way in which this $265 billion giveaway has been given away is optimal, but I can't help feeling that in 10 years' time people will look back at this windfall and say, where the did that go? Because in my view there isn't a great deal of lasting value that we will be able to demonstrate to future generations from this extraordinary once in several generations windfall of revenue dollars that has been raining down on Canberra during the last 5 years. Going forward, although there is no basis, in my view, for expecting a major downturn in the Australian economy, nor is there really any obvious candidate to draw obvious rationale for a further spurt of growth. So instead, in my view, the Australian economy is likely to sort of muddle along at somewhere like the growth rates of 2.5% to 3% that we have become accustomed to over the last 2 years. Effectively, there's a speed limit on our growth rate at around 3%. We can exceed it to the extent that it is driven by foreigners' demand for our product, that is, particularly as investment projects in the mining sector come on stream. But any attempt on the part of economic policy, be it monetary policy or fiscal policy, to engineer growth in domestic demand in excess of 3% is likely to result in higher inflation, a bigger current account deficit, or both. Fortunately, the signs are that the inflation scare of last year is now receding a bit, and therefore the Reserve Bank has no need further to increase interest rates at a time or during a year when to do so would be particularly inconvenient for the government. Indeed, it's possible that late this year, after the election, or early next year, interest rates could be brought down a little bit, although it's most unlikely for the foreseeable future that the cash rate will fall below 5.5%, which the Reserve Bank designates as neutral. interest rates and commodity prices will continue to exercise a major influence on the exchange rate. Over the past 2 years, those two forces have been working in opposite directions rather than in the same direction as they normally do, so that the Australian dollar has traded within what for it is an unusually narrow range of about 4 or 5 cents. Going forward, the fact that US interest rates may begin falling before Australian interest rates start to would be a factor putting upward pressure on the exchange rate, and that's why the dollar wobbles whenever markets have reason to believe that the Reserve Bank or the Federal Reserve might be on the cusp of raising or lowering interest rates. But another key influence will be the outlook for commodity prices. This is something I, like many other observers, have been wrong about over the last 15 months. That is to say, commodity prices have surprised almost everyone, including the companies which produce them, by continuing to go up, defying predictions that they have reached a peak. Nonetheless, the last 3 months have seen almost no significant change in commodity prices on average. Nickel, for example, has continued to go up, but copper and oil, in particular, have eased off some. I think we probably are close to, if not just past, the turning point in commodity prices, partly because of slower growth in demand from the United States, partly because of increased supply of commodities, including out of Australia itself. And so while commodity prices are likely to remain high by historical standards for the foreseeable future, nonetheless, I think they will be easing from the extremely high levels we've seen in recent months. And therefore, when we combine those two factors together, we come to the conclusion that the Australian dollar is likely to ease back some towards the low 70s over the next 12 months and possibly a little lower than that going into 2008. Let me just finish, if I may, with a couple of observations about the so-called two-speed pattern of growth across the Australian economy. This should not come as a surprise to anyone that during a commodities boom, parts of Australia which nature has richly endowed with mineral commodities are going to be growing faster than those parts of the country which haven't been so blessed. Moreover, if you think about the impact that commodity prices have on the exchange rate, as I've just described, it also should follow logically that those parts of the country which have an above average share of industries which don't benefit from high commodity prices, but which are exposed to movements in the exchange rate, such as manufacturing and agriculture, will have an additional negative effect, as well as the absence of the positive effect that the commodity price boom provides to WA, Northern Territory and Queensland. And South Australia, Tasmania and Victoria are, of course, more vulnerable on that latter score than other parts of the country are. In fact, the dispersion between the fastest growing and slowest growing states in recent years is not only by no means unusual by historical standards, but based on state treasury forecasts, is actually expected to get smaller over the next few years rather than bigger. The reason why there is so much attention to the divergence between the growth performance of the different states at the moment, I suspect, is not because it's happening, but because somewhat unusually, New South Wales is coming last. And Sydney people tend to think that there is little intelligent life beyond either Liverpool or Balmain, depending on which of Sydney's two papers you read, and that it is what happens to Sydney is the be-all and end-all of what happens to economic policy. After all, the Treasurer of New South Wales has recently suggested that the Federal Treasurer should intervene in the Reserve Bank setting of monetary policy in order to twist it in order to suit the needs of New South Wales. New South Wales's problem doesn't actually stem from not having any commodities. After all, New South Wales is the second biggest exporter of Australia's largest commodity export, namely coal. Rather, New South Wales' problems stem from a decade of anti-growth economic and population policies pursued by the Carr government, which, to their credit, Morrissey Emma and Michael Costa have put into reverse. Although, as South Australians and Victorians and Tasmanians know, when your state has been adversely affected by a decade of bad economic policies, it takes more than a year of good ones to start producing any significant improvement. South Australia is still losing population to other states. And apart from New South Wales, it's the only state that is now doing that. South Australia has been more successful in attracting migration from overseas, partly because Bob Carr spent the last 10 years telling migrants from overseas to go somewhere else, and eventually they started to get the message. And so South Australia's population growth is actually starting to accelerate, which has been a source of offset to the absence of stimulus from the resources boom and the adverse consequences for South Australia's other industries of a strong exchange rate. But South Australia's real problem, the long-term solution which this state and my own home state of Tasmania both need to get serious about, is a low level of productivity. South Australia has the third lowest level of productivity, that is output per hour worked in the nation, and while Queensland ranks slightly below South Australia on that front, Queensland is at least generating an above average rate of productivity growth, and therefore can have some basis for expecting the gap between it and the national average to narrow over the next 10 years. Whereas South Australia actually has the second lowest rate of productivity growth in the nation after New South Wales, which, given New South Wales' economic performance over the last few years, is hardly anything to be proud of. The point here about, or one of the important points about productivity, is that it is something that has to be taken into account, and businesses do take into account when assessing other competitive advantages. South Australia, like Tasmania, often likes to say that one of its principal competitive advantages is having relatively low labour costs. And measured in terms of output per hour worked, that's true. Whether it's actually a good thing to have the lowest paid workers in the country or not, from a social point of view, is, I guess, for others to judge. But when you factor South Australia's below average productivity against its below average wages, to look at labour costs in the way that a business would, as costs per dollar of output produced, then South Australia's alleged labour cost advantage disappears, as does Tasmania's. One of the main reasons why South Australia and Tasmania have lower than average productivity in their workplaces is because their workforces are less skilled than those of other states. As is the case with Tasmania, that's partly because the most skilled people tend to be forced or choose to move to the bigger capitals on the east coast, and I don't deny that that's a long problem. Indeed, I'm an example of it myself as far as Tasmania is concerned. But South Australia does have a below average proportion of people with post-secondary qualifications and an above average proportion of people who have not completed the highest level of secondary education. So it should come as no surprise that South Australia has a below average proportion of people in the highest skilled occupations with the highest levels of productivity and an above average proportion of people with the lowest skilled occupations and the lowest levels of productivity. One other factor which may contribute to South Australia's longer-term economic underperformance is the fact that historically South Australians have chosen to have high standards of public services, which you do, and to pay for them by relatively high state taxes in part. Now, there's nothing wrong with that as a choice. It is not fiscally irresponsible to do that in the way that Victoria was, for example, in the 1980s, by having high rates of high standards of public services, but refusing to impose high rates of taxation in order to pay for them. And Queensland's traditional position of having very poor quality public services in order to allow state taxes to be much lower than in the rest of the country might not be sustainable either, as Queenslanders who use their health system or transport system are increasingly beginning to find out. But it may well be that South Australians over the longer period of time need to think about whether what's been a tradition here of having very good quality public services funded by higher levels of state taxation relative to South Australians' ability to pay than in any other part of the country might not have some impact on the state's ability to attract investment and employment from other parts of the country. So there are some longer-term issues for South Australia to be thinking about now that the fiscal difficulties that were inherited from the early 1990s appear to have been overcome. Global and national economic circumstances should be reasonably helpful to sorting those things out, and maybe they are some of the questions which others will address in the course of this conference. Thank you very much for the time you've allowed me today.